The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Scott Geisel. He's got a new novel out. It's called Orca's Call, and he joins us in studio here in Yellow Springs. And it's apparently a new series. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Vic. It's nice to be back here at YSO in lovely and wintry Yellow Springs, Ohio.
What made you decide to start a new series?
Well, it was going to be one book, so I say in a new series optimistically, right? So I've already envisioned the second one, but I've only written one. So, you know, but if I say it's a new series, it's more likely to actually become a new series. What made me want to write another one is I wrote the first one, and I just love these characters. I love what they're doing. I love where they are, and I immediately had an idea for another story for them, and I thought, well, it ain't over yet, so I'm going to write another one.
Why do you love them?
They have a banter. You know, there's two characters here. It's Nils.
You mean they bandy.
They bandy. Yes, yeah. They actually have a conversation here about, are we bantering? Are we bandying? What are we doing here? So they talk back and forth. And it was really engaging for me to write. And I think that's one of the good things about the book. It keeps you engaged when the characters are talking. So I went into it thinking it's going to be two points of view. Nils is Nilsson Garner. Goes by Nils, and Bly is Warbly Milkoff, and it's Nils and Bly. And then I thought, you know, there's some mystery here. That works better from one point of view, because then you don't know what this guy doesn't know. You can follow your protagonist, the mystery's greater, because you only know what he knows. But then when Bly appears on the page, she was such a great character, I immediately thought, oh, this book is going to be it's definitely going to be more about her than I had originally envisioned. And the more the book went, the more it became, this is not a Nils story. This is a Nils and Bly story. They don't know each other. So we get to see them get to know each other as they work through some, you know, pretty adventurous and mysterious situations. And by the end of the thing, I think, like me, as the writer, I was rooting for them to get together. You know, so I hope readers feel the same.
Are you telling us that they get together? Is that what you're
telling
us? Are you spoiling this for our listeners?
I'm telling you that you're, as a reader, you're supposed to wish for them to get together, you know, this is one of the things, right? So,
okay.
You're right, you know, if you get are the characters going to get together, going to not get together? If it's a typical, you know, romance story, you know they're going to get together. If it's not a typical romance story, which this is, there's some mystery in it. And so that's where I wanted to put readers.
Am I pronouncing this right? Orca's Call?
Orca's Call, yeah.
Okay. Scott Geisel in studio for this possibly new series. It's at least one novel to start with, and you were kind of tiptoeing along there being vague and generic about the story because obviously there's a lot to spoil here. We meet Nils at the beginning, and he's exercising, and I think it's okay to talk about him a little bit, but we get about 100 pages into the book before we really get much of a sense of who he is because he's a very mysterious person. And then Bly is even more mysterious, and we can't really talk about her hardly at all, who she is.
There's a lot of spoilers, aren't there? Yeah.
Right. So how do we talk about this?
Nils doesn't know he's in trouble. Nils, he's just come off a bad experience on a job. He was a wilderness guide in Northern California. Things didn't go real well. He sort of wants to get away and decompress. He wants to be alone. Only something happened on this trip and he doesn't know it. And then he's trying to be alone. And these factors coming that he's not aware of come to find him. And we learned this as he's running up Mount Constitution on Orca's Island. And Orca's Island is the San Juan Islands in the very northwest part of the state, and he's gone there to be alone, and he's gone to one of the most remote places, and he's going to run up this mountain because that's what he does, and he just wants to be alone, and someone comes behind him. And he's like, well, I'm young, I'm fit, I can run. So he picks up the pace, and well, this guy's not going to catch me. And it's a mysterious and enigmatic woman who says, don't go to the top of the mountain. There's trouble waiting there for you that you don't understand. And that's how the mystery begins. So he's enigmatic. She's enigmatic. They're enigmatic together. And they have to learn whether they can trust each other or not while these other forces that Nils isn't aware of are coming after him.
You said when he was this wilderness guide that he didn't know that something happened. Well, he knew something happened. He just doesn't know what it represents.
Right. And so there's a precipitating event at the beginning of the novel, and it's a kind of adventurous scene where he ends up, he'd been kind of off the radar, right? And he gets on a national news story, and that kind of blows his cover. He doesn't know he's blowing his cover because he doesn't know he's in trouble, but that's what brings all the forces after him. So, like you said, there's a lot of spoilers, but I think that's one of the things you want in a mystery or a story that has some adventure and mysteries, not to know too much about what's to come.
Well, I'm leaving the spoilage to you because I did notice throughout the book that whenever they get fruit, it's always fresh fruit. Yes. And so I know that if something's spoiled, that's your job.
Yeah, it's true.
And I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
The book is Orca's Call. Scott Geisel wrote it. It's a Mills and Bligh novel. Okay, so I'm sure we have readers out there and listeners who are familiar with some of your other work, including a series that's set right here in our area. So I'm wondering about this change of venue. Is this somewhere that you've visited, that you've experienced, that you fell in love with? Is that why you chose this?
Yeah, well, kind of my wife fell in love with it. So if you look in the beginning of the book, there's a dedication. My wife's name is Pam, and the dedication goes something like this. This one's for Pam. She says other people go on trips and they get a t-shirt and pictures. She gets an adventure novel. So what happens is we'd been a couple of times on the West Coast previously in the Redwoods, and it's one of her favorite places. A couple of summers ago, we got some friends who said, hey, we're going to go out hiking in the Cascades. Come join us. That's in Washington, not too far from the Redwoods. And we said, well, we can't try to swing that. We'll meet up with you. And they said, we'll spend some time there and then we'll scoot down to the Redwoods. And so we started with these friends, and they said, oh, we're going to take you up to Orca's Island. And we'd been in the San Juans, but not there. And we happened to land the day before the solstice, the summer solstice, which, you know, it's June. It's a good time to travel. And these people are like, hey, we got this great parade. You got to stay for this parade. It's the most amazing thing. You won't believe this parade. Or like a parade, whatever. So we went down to the parade the next day, and it was like the coolest thing ever. Kids holding up a giant globe that they're balancing and tossing around, and people on stilts, and, you know, it was magical. And, you know, Pam, my wife Pam, looks at me and says, wow, this would be a great scene in a novel. And then we traveled on the Olympic Peninsula. Oh, this would be a great, we went to Squim, a lavender farm in Squim that some friends own, and they said, wow, this would make a great scene in a novel. We traveled down the coast to some of our favorite places. We go to False Klamath, Northern California, and we climb up this, there's a mountain climb up there that we like to do. She said, this would be a great place for a novel. So that's why the dedication is, she's like, you should set a novel out here. So the dedication to Pam, some of her favorite places are where these characters, Nils and Bligh, have their adventures.
Does she do that to you a lot, where you go somewhere and now you have to write a novel about it?
I'll tell you this. She had told me for a long time before, there's a Jackson Flint mystery series, and they're set in right where we are. They're set in Yellow Springs and surrounding areas. And she told me before I wrote that series, she told me for several years, she said, you should write a mystery series where we live. Because when we travel, we like to find small places, small towns. We like to find little independent bookstores. And we like to go get a coffee, find the local independent bookstore, and walk in and say, where's your local author section? You got anybody here that writes mysteries set where we are? And so we'd been doing this for years. And she's like, why don't you do that, right? We go to Martha's Vineyard and you find Philip R. Craig and you read the book set where we are. We go to Baltimore and you find an Ann Tyler book and you read the book set where we are. She's like, set one where we are in Yellow Springs. So she doesn't tell me much about my writing, but when she does, she's spot on. Write a series in Yellow Springs. Write a series on the West Coast. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO 91.3 on your dial, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. I've been joined in studio by Scott Geisel. We're talking about his Mills and Blind novel that came out just the other day. It's called Orca's Call. And obviously, I'm still dancing around spoilers here, but by page 200, we figure out, okay, this thing that you've alluded to looks like it's probably happening. And this really changes the dynamic of everything, doesn't it?
It does. So there's some sort of key moments in the story. And again, dancing around some spoilers, Bly, you know, gets to Nil before these other forces that are coming after him and says, you know, trust me, not them. And she's got to convince him. He's not going to trust anyone. He's going to just run away, right? So there's a lot of time with her trying to convince him, you know, she's his way out. She can help him. But there's something they both want. And a couple of key moments are she's going to explain her backstory, but it sort of doesn't happen. It doesn't happen until there's a moment where she has him. He's a super captive audience. He's got nowhere to go. And she says, I'm going to tell you my story. And then if you like it and you trust me, then it's you and me against, you know, the world. And so that's kind of a turning point. And then they go off down to the Noyo River Valley, which is runs sort of geographically north of San Francisco, if you know, like the Mendocino area. So sort of significantly north of San Francisco, inwards towards Willits. And this is where the adventure takes them, looking for this mysterious thing they have to find to solve to find the way out for them. And they sort of bond over that, and you sort of see the trust sort of happening between them. But then something unexpected happened, and it sends them on a showdown.
When you talk about the captive audience, you're referring to that claustrophobic segment where they're trying to – yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
An interesting situation.
Okay, so, well, it's from my point of view, I had five different scenarios. So Bly has to gain Nil's confidence and get him out of a situation where there's not really a way for them to escape. And I had written out, here's five scenarios. When I get to this chapter, I'm going to pick one of those. And then when I got there, I picked the one that I thought was most implausible, but most interesting, and then I tested out whether that's actually viable, and I thought, oh, that's really cool. I was sort of proud of myself for having written that. And then, you know, a month later when my wife Pam was reading the first draft, she starts laughing, and she says, that's a – and this is the scene that she says gave me the thumbs up on. So
okay, so you were ready for that, but you had five different scenarios, and we're not going to talk about the one you chose, but I want to hear about the other four,
well,
if you can remember them.
Okay, so – and I think this is not a spoiler. They're on Orca's Island. They have to get off the Orca's Island. The only way off and on the island, generally, for most people, is to get a reservation on a Washington State ferry, which they can't do. So there's the water. And they've already been out in the water, and the currents are not always easy to navigate there. So they've already been out in the canoes, and they've considered this. They'll get swept away to Canada. They'll get swept away to Japan. You can't really swim for it. They could go in disguise. And then this other method that we're not going to divulge. They involved water or the ferries.
I realize the stuff that gets tossed off the cutting board isn't really important, but I'm curious about the craft of it and the fact that you had these five different scenarios planned out and you chose one, and you apparently chose the one that your greatest critic and advisor
yes.
reacted to so positively.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's good.
Whew. Yeah, right.
It's all good. All right, so tell us some more that you're allowed to talk about this story, as in how you set it up, because this is very different than your books that are set in Yellow Springs. And the one similarity that I see between those books and this one, other than the fact that they're mysteries, is that in those Yellow Springs books, you have these crazy guys lifting up these car parts and stuff. And as this one opens, this guy's doing this real physical thing. And apparently this bodybuilding thing is like a theme that runs through your stuff.
People say, how long does it take you to write a novel? And I say, well, it takes me a while to think about what it's going to be and sort of, you know, plot out some ideas and some character sketches. But the actual writing time is about 6 weeks. But it's usually about 6 weeks over 9 months because they have other work, which I don't really like to do. So this past summer, I had a stretch in May and June where I didn't have any work. And I did nothing for 4.5 weeks except write this book, run in Glen Helen and John Bryan State Parks, lift weights and eat and sleep. That's all I did. So I think one of the things that I'm doing when I'm writing is I do physical stuff to distract myself from the daily, you know, work or house or just daily life stuff. You got to get yourself distracted. And when you sit down in front of the keyboard to type, all you want to be thinking about is these characters and you want to inhabit them. You got a clear mechanism. You can't think about anything else. So for me, running in the woods and lifting weights does that. So I think it just sort of transposes over into the book. Books.
Why? Well, I heard that you have like an old junk car in your backyard. Is that true?
So it's not me. It's a friend. So no, but I'm known to like to lift heavy things. I know it's a little unusual, but
I'm referring to your series set in Yellow Springs.
Because, oh, got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't referring to you specifically, but it was a joke.
You're talking about Betty. Yeah. From the Jackson Flint series, which Jackson Flint and his buddy Brick for workouts carry the largest car parts around Brick's cabin in the woods.
Okay. That was what I was referring
to. Yes, right.
All right, so we're on Jackson Flint. Tell our readers about Jackson Flint. Who's Jackson Flint and what does he do and how many books and blah, blah, blah?
Okay, so there are 3 books, and Jackson Flint has an office in Yellow Springs. Nobody quite knows exactly where, but it's somewhere downtown. He is a traditional small-town PI. He used to work for the county sheriff. He got off the pension, hung his own shingle. He's widowed. He's raising a teenage daughter, Callie. And he's got a love interest, Marzi. Marzi is short for marzipan, if there's any fans of marzipan there. And Callie is short for calliope. And he's got the usual cast of friends. He's got his big buddy, Brick, who is an ex-Marine, and when it comes to heavy lifting, he's the loyal guy at your side who's going to do the heavy work. And he's got Jalea, who's also an ex-Marine, who's sort of been mentored by Brick, and she's the tech expert. And they take on adventures here in the Greene County area. So, for example, the first one is a traditional missing person. Woman's been missing 20 years, and when she resurfaces, she looks like she hasn't aged at all. So there's the first mystery. The second one was very generously and graciously inspired by my friend Chuck Buster, whose family, and I learned this at a book talk after the first novel, his family escaped from slavery in Maysville, Kentucky, stole a horse, swam across the Ohio River on the horse, and settled. His question to me was, he said, have you ever heard of Tawana Springs or Tawawa Springs? And I said, no idea what you're talking about. He said, well, it used to be what was before Wilberforce University. Turns out this is one of the places where the Abbots were and people would settle, and his family was a result of that. So the second one story has a mysterious cabin in the woods. It dates all the way back to then. The third story, that's the Water to Bind. For fans of the Cowboys movie with John Wayne, you'll know that this is Mr. Nightlinger's recipe for apple pie, includes Water to Bind. That's where the title comes from. The third one in the series is Wheat Penny. Wheat Penny is a mysterious compound out in the rural areas around the village, and it involves an actual penny, and it involves the Wheat Penny restaurant in Dayton, Ohio, my friend Liz Valenti owns. And I asked her one day, I was standing there, and she showed me a picture there in the restaurant, and I said, oh, this picture is going to inspire my next novel. And she said, go ahead, do it. So those three stories in the series are Fair Game, Water to Bind, and Wheat Penny. And soon to come, another one is underway.
So that series continues with Jackson Flint, and Scott Geisel might write another Nielsen Bly novel if he decides that's where he wants to go. And when I was reading about Niels, I kept flashing on Lee Child, and I kept flashing on Jack Reacher because, number one, we've got this guy, Niels, who's just wandering around, and he's compelled to just wander around, and he drinks coffee all the time.
Yeah, so I would have been surprised if he hadn't brought up the Jack Reacher, because we may have talked about this in the past. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, Reacher's a wanderer, and Niels is a wanderer. And Reacher's a little different. He's a big guy who gets in a lot of fights. Niels is a little different. He's a guy who likes to stay fit, but he likes to stay out of the way, under the radar.
I don't know. I think the story starts off with a very Jack Reacher kind of move.
Well, okay.
I don't think anyone else does stuff like that.
All right. So I'll tell you where that came from. I know you know the Nick Petrie novels with Peter Ash, the ex-Marine, and then he likes to start those novels like a James Bond movie. So often it's disassociated from the rest of the novel, but it's some super active scene. So James Bond is falling out of an airplane. He doesn't have a parachute. He's got to fly through the air and get the guy with the parachute and take it off of him. He's skiing down the mountain. He's being shot, something like that. Nick Petrie wrote this book where it starts where he's got a pair of work boots and he's holding on to a gurney that's come out of the back of an ambulance flying down a steep road that he can't stop and the bottom of his shoes are getting. And my wife said, oh, that's a great scene. You ought to have a really active scene at the beginning of one of your novels. So I thought, you know what? We need a precipitating event for Orca's call. So I thought, let's have him do something a little crazy. And I did actually think a little bit of Reacher and Petrie.
I'll bet you did. Speaking of inspirations, we've talked about this in previous interviews. Tell us about some of your current discoveries, maybe some new authors that you've stumbled upon that you were impressed with. And they don't necessarily have to be mystery writers, but just authors in general.
Okay, so I've been reading a little science fiction, and I stumbled across it's the Wayfarer series, and maybe you can come up with the author's name. Don't know if I can, but it starts with the Wayfarer series. There's four of them in it, and they're each a little different. Sort of, you have one cast of characters, and then one character that would carry the other one. So I highly recommend the Wayfarer series, that book of four. I am just now embarking on my first. Kellerman, what's his first name? Novel, the mystery series.
Jonathan Kellerman.
Jonathan Kellerman just started literally today. My first Jonathan Kellerman. Recently, Andy Carpenter, the guy with the dogs in New Jersey, David Rosenfeld. Yeah,
He puts out a Christmas book every year. He puts out two books a year.
Yeah, and they've got dogs.
They're on Minotaur. They've always got dogs in them.
Yes, dashing through the snow. Just really great stuff. So, those are some examples.
Yeah, those are very formulaic. I know someone who really enjoys that series.
Oh, good. Me too.
Yeah. and to be able to produce like that, every 6 months, a new book, that's really something. That takes incredible focus.
It does. It takes a lucky ability not to have a lot of other job or life things to do. I think a lot of writers, given the chance to just write, could probably be pretty productive. But I think a lot of us have larger life stepping in on our ability to keep that focus as we work.
You mean like a day job?
Like a day job and an old house to work on, yeah.
You mean writers aren't like independently wealthy just from their books? They can't just relax and just sit there every morning and just...
Well, you may have met a couple, but I the ones I know are far, far from that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't get rich overnight writing fiction, do you?
No, you know... It's okay. So here's something interesting. I have a lot of friends who are writers and some colleagues who are writers, colleagues that I have now and have had in the past. And a lot of them say, you know, they like to have written, but they don't like to write because it's pressure. It's difficult. I hear this over and over. I'm so glad when I'm done. I'm glad to have written something. But I'm the opposite. I'm like, oh boy, I get to go home and write. I mean, I love the process. I can't wait to get down, sit down in the chair. I can't wait to start typing. I can't wait for the world to melt away. So, you know, to me, as soon as I've finished a novel, I get this little down. Oh, I can't wait to start the next one because that's the part I like.
Hmm.
So I guess I'm lucky in that way. But given some time, I can see how you could be productive.
I love a writer who is so great that they end up, after the writer dies, like Robert Parker, they end up franchising the books. But it kind of bothers me when they do that too, because, I mean, how many people have they had write the Parker books? There must be a half dozen so far, and it's never stopping. It's crazy.
They can't quite get the right one. And they also extended the Jesse Stone, and I really like Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone series too. And then they got someone else to write that one, and immediately got really dark and violent. And one of the things I liked about Parker was he wasn't overly dark and violent. So it is hard to keep that writer's voice when someone takes over. So I guess another example is, it just escaped me.
Robert Ludlum.
Okay, that's an example.
Stuart Woods.
Stuart Woods. I was thinking of the ones with the two on the Indian reservations out in the Southwest, and her name is it's escaping me.
I assume she's dead.
No, her father wrote 30 or 40 books, and then she took over and sort of took him in. But what she did is that she took him in a slightly different direction. So her father had written this large body of these two main lead characters.
Hillerman.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. And then she sort of took her own characters in a different way. And I thought, well, that kind of works because she's not trying to be her father's characters.
Oh.
She's trying to franchise it with sort of a branch of her own characters off her father. So I sort of appreciated that a little bit more.
Well, I actually respect the franchises that stop. Well, Sue Grafton, for example, she had that last book in her Alphabet series with Kinsey Millhone, and she never did the last book because she died. And the estate has not authorized anybody to write that final book, and I think that is a lovely thing. Let's just leave it the way it is because nobody wrote those books like she wrote them.
That's true. She stopped, and they stopped at 25. They never got Z, did they?
Nope.
Yeah. No,
so
I get that.
I admire that. A number of years ago, I got a email from a publisher, and they said, you got to read the new Robert Ludlum. And I emailed back, and I said, is he doing interviews? and they didn't appreciate my sense of humor. But that's another franchise where it's just gone on and on and on. I know there are people out there who love those books. I'm not criticizing anybody who reads a book. You could read whatever you want. Good book, bad book, franchised book, original book. I don't care. Just keep reading. But that's just my own personal taste. And we all have it.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of writers. Brady Quinn series, William G. Tapley, one of my favorite writers. And then when he passed away, I thought, well, no more. He just started the new books with Stoney Calhoun. And I was like, oh, my gosh. You know, he wrote three, and he was cranking these things out. And I thought, oh, good, 10 more years of writing these novels. And they haven't continued that, but I can't imagine anyone having picked up on that nuance of a character. So I understand what you're saying.
Now, who's this writer again?
William G. Tapley, who is most known for the Brady Quinn series, sort of a Robert B. Parker and Jeremiah Healy contemporary in Boston, writing in the same time, 70s, 80s, 90s, and then started a new series called Stoney Calhoun right at the end of his life.
Well, I think you have to be a certain level of famous where the publisher says, we can't lose this revenue stream. We've got to find somebody to keep writing these books. The estate is totally cool with it. They don't want to lose this revenue stream. We got to keep doing this. I know I'm being cynical here, but.
Yeah, I'd be so lucky to be one of those guys one day.
There you go. Well, you never know, Scott. When you're gone and they're reissuing all your stuff, you just won't know.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you coming by and talking to us about your new one.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always nice to be here. It's always good conversation.
My guest has been Scott Geisel, and the new one is Orca's Call. It's a Niels and Bly novel, and maybe there will be more, because when you get to the end of the book, you go, okay, what's next for these two? And what was that sound I heard in the distance? Is that some sort of a whale talking to me?
I think the orcas are calling.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.